Question mark to the original title, just to not sound too sure of myself, but I am going to argue, yes, that why don't we step back and consider classical fields here. So after setting up what Lee Smolin likes to call the Newtonian schema and a couple other important distinctions to make as far as laws versus boundary conditions, I can basically set up the basic framework, which is take classical fields and impose not initial boundary conditions, but closed hypersurface boundary conditions on in space-time and see what results. The first order, very easily get some uncertainty of an epistemic variety, not your usual quantum uncertainty. You get a little simple quantization that naturally emerges that's not very impressive, but I'll just mention what it is. The most exciting thing, the first order, and the reason I've been working on this and have really changed fields to pursue this, is seeing this natural contextuality come out of simply imposing boundary conditions in this funny manner, even on a totally classical system. The new technical results that nobody's really seen yet, and will go up on the archive later this week, I believe, is what happens when you apply this to a classical relativistic scalar field. And the new result is quantization of angular momentum with one conjecture that some of you may already accept. It's, we'll get to the conjecture in a bit. And then in that context, which is a totally classical context, we can now look at the measurement problem and things in quantum foundations in a classical light and perhaps make a little more sense. So I'm talking about ontology, I'm talking about ontic states, and I'm talking about what I see as real, and that word probably means very different things to most people in here. So I'll just throw out what I mean by a realistic interpretation, and hopefully what you mean by a realistic interpretation of quantum mechanics fits most of that. And simply, I just want to do quantum mechanics on space-time diagrams. I want to have a block universe framework where nothing's changing because time is written, is drawn as a spatial dimension. So I want to do, I want an interpretation that's obviously compatible with the block universe. And I think an important point to make here is that we've got to keep GR and relativity in the back of our minds when we do quantum foundations if we're looking for realistic structures, because there's no such thing as non-relativistic reality. I mean, if we're trying to figure out what's really down there, we should use all the tools at our disposal. And certainly knowledge of relativity and general relativity is critical in figuring out what's going on. Now, a lot of people try to come up with realistic interpretations. I would say most of them are on the left side of this diagram using classical particles. And the obvious reason for that is right away, right off the bat, you get this result that your measurements of these particles are naturally going to be localized. Of course, you cannot recover all of quantum theory with just particles. And so typically, when you're doing Bohmian interpretation or stochastic electrodynamics or whatever, you end up adding ontic fields anyway that tend to actually be as if not equally problematic as quantum theory was to begin with, in my view. So I'm interested in just starting with classical fields right off the bat, no particles whatsoever. And now you get the wave aspect of the wave particle duality. And unlike particles, which really can't ever be delocalized, at least it's possible to have a localized field. Right? You can have a field that is localized, and so it's not out of the question that you could get particle-like behavior out of these fields. I think by far the strongest reason to pursue this is it's the natural analog of quantum field theory. All the fantastic predictions of quantum field theory got to be tied closely into something that's really going on. And if you have a quantum Dirac field, you don't retreat from that all the way to the electron. The natural point of retreat, if you want to go back to classical theory, is a classical Dirac field, where they're not operators, but just numbers everywhere in space-time rather than operators. So you can use all your usual Lagrangians and generate a corresponding classical field theory to the standard model. Yes?
So a clarification question about definition of a realistic interpretation. You want something that I can think of as a 4D block.
Okay.
Suppose that I say, okay, my toy little universe is going to consist of a 4D block space-time, and I define a field, some simple scalar field or something, and I quantize it. So at every point there's a Hilbert space, and I've got some field equation, and I solve that, and bang. So I've got some very complex structure, but it's defined on this 4D space-time. It's a solution to the quantum field theory.
Okay.
Motions. Now, my problem with that is that either nothing ever happens because there's no events and there's no measurements, uh-huh. or I seem to violate relativity. I violate locality and stuff. But my question is, would you be happy with that, the one where nothing ever happens? Because it does seem to be compatible.
Nothing can happen in a block universe. And the block universe is static by definition. If Chris Fuchs were here, we've debated whether the block universe works with quantum theory, and he liked to say, I like to think that things happen, which is why he doesn't like the block universe. But obviously, if we're in the universe, we see things happen because we're experiencing time and order. But yeah, absolutely. I'm going to have a bunch of block universe diagrams on here. Pretty much every diagram I have will be have time axis. And of course, nothing can change on that diagram.
Okay, but do you also demand that this model be compatible with us seeing things happen?
Sure, that's where the boundary conditions come in. And
that's also part of a real
right, right. In fact, okay. So now a lot of you may not like realistic interpretations, or at least think that they're all ruled out by just a vast variety of results that seem to say, okay, classical physics, as great as it is, doesn't work. It's not giving us the right physical phenomena. And maybe even your favorite reason to reject classical physics isn't even up here, but there are many of them. Now, what are all these things telling us? Well, each one of these is an indictment of classical physics, but what does that mean? What it's an indictment of is classical equations of motion, which are just mathematical equations, and then how they tie into physics, how they tie into reality, which is what Lee Smolin likes to call the Newtonian schema. And it's critical here that we realize that physics is not just the laws. You can have equations of motion but not predict anything, because if you don't have any boundary conditions on the system, you can't get any results from the equations of motion. So if you want to do physics, you have to put physical boundary conditions on your equations of motion in order to solve it. So what's the Newtonian schema? Basically, you might start with the block universe, but in order to define the state space, you need to sort of pick a foliation or something and get your state space. Typically, you put it in three dimensions, and you don't want that state space to change with the fourth dimension of time. And then you determine your initial state via initial boundary conditions, and maybe you don't even know it for sure. Maybe there's some probabilistic distribution of states, but you determine it best you can, and then you use your equation of motions to time evolve it. And that's how we've all been taught to do physics our whole lives. That's the way physics is done. And basically, 8 years ago, when all these things started emerging, that is what was given up on. You say, okay, let's toss the equations of motion, but hold on to the Newtonian schema, because that is how we do physics. And we're not going to get rid of that. However, now, 8 years in, still without a theory of quantum gravity, people are starting to think, and I've heard Smolin say this, that we have to get rid of maybe this as well. We have to get rid of this Newtonian schema and replace it with something else. And that's fine to do, and I am going to actually encourage that. But the question is, should we go all the way back to the beginning and throw back in the classical equations of motion and throw out the Newtonian schema and see if that might explain a lot of these phenomena rather than toss them both simultaneously? Yeah.
What does the Godkin's Becker theorem have to do with equations of motion?
I guess it has to do with the Newtonian schema. Really. That's my argument, but I will get to that. I will definitely get to that. Okay, so what can we replace the Newtonian schema with? Believe it or not, there is a well-known alternative that everyone here knows. Whether you view it as an alternative is another question entirely, but there is an alternative. So the Newtonian schema, say for a single particle, we'll get to fields in a bit, is you put your initial boundary conditions on, initial position, initial velocity, run it forward in time with your equations of motion, presto, you have your physics. The alternative is Lagrangian schema, where instead of equations of motion, you start with the Lagrangian, you construct the action, you make sure the variation of that action is zero, under the constraints of initial and final conditions, say initial position and a final position, for example, on a particle. Now, people often say these are totally equivalent, but they're not equivalent. You end up with the same equations of motion, but you have different boundary conditions on the system. In this case, you have initial boundary condition all at the beginning, and the other case, you have more symmetrical boundary conditions at the end. And if you're going to physically constrain a physical system, or if you're going to constrain a physical system, it has to be a physical constraint, I think. It's sort of a tautology there. These boundary conditions have to be constraints on physical systems, which means they have to be some form of interaction or measurement or whatever you're going to call it. And the way I think about it is these boundary conditions exist in almost independently of the fields that they constrain. They are ontic things that are ontic in the sense that they are real external physical constraints on systems. If I'm going to measure a particle and find it's in the small localized region, there is a physical constraint at that time that whatever I'm measuring has to be in that localized region. And the only way you come about from these ontic boundary conditions is an interaction. You can't mathematically come, okay, here's my boundary condition, I'm just going to write it down. That's not imposing anything on a system. You have to physically impose it, or it's not one of these ontic boundary conditions. So the thesis of the seminar is basically, let's just take the schema, apply it to classical fields, and see what happens. And the argument is, I'm going to walk through here, is what you get is a quantum-like theory that is psi epistemic by Rob's definition and sort of fits in with his research program, I believe, except that it's fields and not necessarily particles. Okay, one other quick motivation before I get into the results is that when we do experiments on subsystems in space-time, what can we see about a subsystem? What we can see is its boundary in some space-time region. Lucian's talked a lot about this, about what sort of correlations you can get between different space-time regions. But basically, if you're only going to get local information from the subsystem, where you get it, where you access it, is on this some three-dimensional hypersurface around the subsystem, which is exactly where you impose the boundary condition on the covariant action when you're doing Lagrangian path integrals. In four dimensions. So it all matches, right? Where you get your information, where you're constraining the subsystem, is on a closed hypersurface in space-time. And we do this mathematically all the time. The question is, are we really taking it seriously enough? The one concern I have with the way normally we do this is that even though we're doing it this way, we tend to treat the past portion of the hypersurface differently than the future portion. And that, in turn, requires some foliation in space-time. That, in turn, I think, helps lead to this problem of time in quantum gravity, but I'm going to argue for just treating this whole boundary as on the same footing. It's not fair to treat the past of it differently from the future.
What do you mean by the past portion?
The past portion meaning the initial measurement, the preparation, if you like, as opposed to the measurement.
The white hypersurface is the bounding hypersurface.
Yes. This is all these diagrams are block universe diagrams with time going up. Except for the three-dimensional ones. Okay, so what are the consequences of this? Well, it's sort of trivial to see that if this is what's really going on, you only have an initial condition and final condition, but we as human agents, as Robin wanted me to talk about, are sort of moving through time. I hate that phrase, but we are experiencing time going in that direction. Before that final boundary condition is measured, we don't have complete information to solve it using Newton's laws. And we're basically put in the position of having to guess what's going to happen because we do not have sufficient initial data to solve the equation of motion. We can solve it after the fact once we get a final boundary condition, but we get this uncertainty. Now, this is not like your typical quantum uncertainty. It's called the uncertain Newtonian schema, where you still only have initial boundaries, but they're not sufficient to determine what's going on. And this is a lot like the initial uncertainty principle back before the modern Heisenberg uncertainty principle, but Heisenberg's original argument that, say, a particle really has a position and a velocity, you just can't measure them both at the same time. Why wouldn't you be able to measure them both? Well, if one thing is governed, if these boundary conditions are really ontic, that's really how it is, the subsystem is constrained by a closed hypersurface boundary, this is still time. How are we going to measure that? Well, we measure it with a measurement device, but that in turn is a subsystem. And unless we use the Newtonian schema on this measurement device, we can't get all the initial boundaries on the subsystem for the same reason that we can't get the initial. Basically, it's this infinite regress, right? So in order to get both boundaries on this one, you need another measurement device, and it goes all the way back to the Big Bang. And so presumably, I guess, well, I'll talk about cosmology at the end. But the point is that these uncertainties are not your typical quantum uncertainties. They are epistemic uncertainties. You simply do not know the velocity of the particle at this time. That's not at all to say that it doesn't exist. It does exist as a well-defined in the block universe. Nothing can come into existence. It's just there. There is a velocity. We just don't know what it is. So this is an epistemic uncertainty.
This is supposed to be a statement about any classical field theory?
There's a classical field theory governed by these closed hypersurface boundaries. If you are using Lagrangian schema and a way to impose boundary conditions, as opposed to the Newtonian schema, then you don't have enough initial information to solve your system of equations. I don't have a velocity.
I couldn't just use the schema and get F equals F.
We'll talk about whether we have to drop back to the Newtonian schema. Okay. But then it's a matter of, can we find out what the position of the momentum are, which of course we now know we can't actually get those to arbitrary precision.
Ken, you're not providing here a reason why we should only have one of the two possible initial boundary conditions, but rather consistency, that if you imagine that your measurement device only, if you can only identify one of the two, say position or velocity, then that will also be true.
Of the one that it measures and the one that it measures, yes. It's sort of, it's a chain reaction that fills the whole universe, right? Okay, so let's see what happens as far as imposing two-time boundary conditions on these problems. Nobody seems to have any trouble with two spatial boundary conditions, getting half an integer number of wavelengths between the two boundaries. You could argue that, I assume something similar must happen. If you do two time boundaries between initial measurement and the final measurement, wouldn't you get now an half integer number of periods between those two measurements, sort of by the same logic? There are some subtleties to this I can go into if anyone's interested afterward, but let's run with this and look at what quantization emerges, knowing that there are half integer number of periods between this time thing. Basically, we get a quantized frequency spectrum, which probably doesn't look like any quantized frequency spectrum you've ever seen before. It's not something that typically comes up in quantum mechanics. But if you think about it, when can we actually measure this to sufficient accuracy to see such a discrete spectrum? You have to, if you want to see the discrete spectrum, you better be able to experimentally control that time difference quantum. And I've pondered this, and the only system I can think of that you can actually experimentally control such a thing is a laser cavity. And the nice thing about a laser cavity is you know the velocity of the photons, so basically think about the time, you can control the time between measurements, or the time between interactions with the mirrors, just simply by tuning it up. And you plug that in, you discover that, well, sure enough, this is exactly the frequency spectrum that emerges from a laser. You get the same frequency spectrum from this logic that we actually physically observe in a laser. Now, this is not at all surprising, because if we just add a laser cavity here, it is that half an integer number of wavelengths is equivalent to half an integer number of periods. You get the exact same result, whichever way you look at it. But it's at least consistent. And in other cases where we can't experimentally measure that, as I'll get to in a few view graphs, we would not expect to see this particular type of quantization. So this is sort of a boring type of quantization, since you can get it elsewhere. But at least it's all self-consistent. We're not ending up with results that don't correspond to reality. The most exciting consequence right off the bat, and the reason I'm working on this, is what happens if you have two systems that have the same initial boundary conditions, but different final boundaries, different types of measurements, different results of the measurement, different types of measurement is the most interesting one. If these were spatial boundaries, it would not bother anyone at all to see that these two solutions that you go back and retrodict after the fact, or the ontic solutions to these two boundary problems, are going to be different. And yet, as soon as this becomes time, people get a little disturbed here, because now it's saying as if an experimental choice here is going to actually change the ontic structure of the field at an earlier time. This doesn't bother anyone in space. It does bother people in time, but it's exactly the same picture. And the reason it bothers people is because if you're really thinking about ontic boundary condition, as I think a good word for that is a cause of the system, then we are getting into backward causality. However, this is the inaccessible past, right? As Hugh Price likes to call it, it's past thing that you can't measure without actually imposing that final boundary condition to measure it, because all boundary conditions are physical measurements. And so because it's the inaccessible past, you can't actually get any dangerous paradoxes out like you could if you could actually change the accessible past.
Seems to me a more natural response would be that I shouldn't think of the final boundary condition as being a cause for what comes before, but a condition. So if I conditionalize on knowing certain things, then I can infer something. And I can infer facts about the past by conditioning on the future.
Well, here's an example that doesn't work for, the double slit experiment. Let's say I'm convolving now a time dimension and a spatial dimension, say some light or something moving in that direction. But say we have an initial boundary and a final boundary. The field, say you solve the Green's function given a localized field configuration here, and localized field configuration at the final measurement, and you discover that the solution goes through both slits. But then you say, well, wait, what if I do a delayed choice experiment, throw up a lens before the measurement is made? I'm still going to, now the final boundary condition is some other localized position, I impose it. And I say, well, what's the Green's function for this? And that one is going, all the field is just going to go through one slit. Now, in this case, your decision, or some random decision of whether to pop a lens up in here, is actually changing the physics at an earlier time. And to me, that is the natural explanation for what's going on here. And it's not any weird postulate. All I'm doing is taking the Lagrangian schema seriously and saying, well, what are the solutions of these two boundaries in these two cases? And I discover exactly what we see. Yeah.
I want to clarify something. The initial and final boundary conditions, I'm not sure if you mean them to be measurements or outcomes.
They're the choice of measurement and the outcome of that measurement, and the hypersurface on which that measurement is imposed.
Okay, so it's you shouldn't speak of the choice of measurement as influencing. The final choice of measurement is influencing the past, unless you, because without what's missing is the outcome.
Well, okay, the final choice and the outcome together, and the hypersurface on which that measurement is imposed, all together determine the past solution in this boundary. Here.
Right. Why do you need to talk about the choice at all, or is it just it's general?
Well, I guess you don't need a free agent. You could just have a set up. And I guess in a block universe, we're all world minds anyway, just standing there. So.
Right, just as a way, just in order to kind of cut to the essence of what's on offer. It's just it's a set of values. It's by half the data on the past boundary.
Right, right, right. And basically, my point here is that even though this probably has repelled you already from taking this schema seriously, the most exciting feature of it to me is that it naturally addresses the criticisms of going to a realistic classical model in the first place, which is that you can't possibly get this kind of behavior out of a realistic classical model. Well, I see this as a realistic model. I see it as a classical model. You put classical fields in here. And yet I see it, you immediately are getting around all of these no-go theorems. If you'd like to think of it in terms of hidden variables, there are variables you don't know, and epistemic restrictions on them, that are influenced by future boundary conditions. And so basically it's the retrocausality loophole. Only instead of having to put it in, it just naturally comes out of that. Okay, so let's try to move on to actual applications here. I think the best place to start looking at what fields are going to do is the simplest massive field you can come up with. The relativistic scalar field in flat space time, construct the action and extremize it, and the Euler Lagrange equation is the Klein-Gordon equation. The h bar here is to force the dispersion relation of the Klein-Gordon equation to be consistent with the Broglie hypothesis between energy and frequency and momentum and wavelength. Or if you'd like to think about it as a definition of mass, I guess you can define that based on this equation too. But that's where the h-bar is coming in. It's still a classical field in the sense that it's not operator value. It's just numbers everywhere in space-time. In fact, real numbers, and this is focused on the real classical field. You don't have any quantization, even if you have a solution that you think, oh, the solution is special, you can just add it to any other solution and make another solution. So there's no inherent quantization of this field. It's not a quantum field, I want to point out, it's a classical field. And if you look at the analogy to quantum field theory, it's the closest thing you can get to a generic massive covariant field, in the sense it's spinless and neutral, but it's sort of like your generic. If it's ever going to show up as a particle, it's your generic, boring particle that doesn't actually exist, but it's the one we hopefully would map onto quantum mechanics. And many of you have heard me rail on this at length, so I will just mention that it does not reduce the Schrodinger equation in the non-relativistic limit, because in order to go from a second-order differential equation to a first-order differential equation in time, you have to throw out half the solutions, and there's, at this point, no reason to do that. And here it is. There's another way to realize why it's so different. If you want to solve this second-order differential equation in the Newtonian schema, and you only want initial boundary conditions, you have to specify the Cauchy data, the initial value of the field, and the time derivative of the field both, or you cannot solve the equations of motion. The Lagrangian schema, you would only need the initial value of the field, but also the final value of the field, or more generally, the field on a closed hypersurface in space-time. And I hope this, if anything, makes it clear why this is not cannot reduce to the Schrodinger equation, because the Schrodinger equation, you do not need both of these to time-involve the Schrodinger equation.
It's also real, too.
It is real. I guess you have another reason.
I have a question.
Yes.
Because you say, I mean, it's a classical field, right?
But yes.
If you have a wave function that obeys the Schrodinger equation, that's also a classical
field. There is a classical field that corresponds to that. Sure, it's not covariant, but yes. You can view it. I'll hardly get another dose, but absolutely, you could view that in a block universe framework.
So how do you distinguish between a classical field theory and a first quantized quantum?
Well, people like to think, there are a group of people that think that the ordinary solution to the Schrodinger equation is an object state. And then when you measure it, something happens. There's real collapse theory, right? That's a realistic theory. If you put in a real collapse theory, that qualifies to me as a realistic classical theory, and I don't happen to like. We get all sorts of various problems with putting in a real collapse. But I think that would qualify in this framework. It's also not covariant. Okay, so let's see something a little more interesting. What happens when you take such a field and put it in an infinite square well in space and time? This is like a two-dimensional square well, but one of them is time. And now you quantize the momentum in one direction, or the wavelength, with one quantum number, and you quantize the time, the frequency, with another quantum number. But you don't see energy quantization. Why not? Well, when you plug in values of m for particles we know about, you discover that the Compton frequency, even for an electron, is like 10 to the minus 21 seconds. And you cannot constrain the uncertainty in your time to that level. And so because of that, as I discussed before, because the uncertainty in your time is bigger than this quantity, basically any apparent quantization disappears. You don't see the sort of quantization you would see in a laser pattern. However, there's more you can do here. You can take the dispersion relation of the Klein-Gordon equation and plug in these values of omega and k and discover that there's actually a relationship between the quantum number in the time graph, the number of half periods and the number of half wavelengths in the well. There's this funny relationship. If m is zero for a laser, say, now you have many, many solutions. You can increase n by 1 for both of them. But now you can't just arbitrarily increase n by 1 and hope to find a solution in the other n, right? And if these n's are integers, and depending on exactly what this quantity is, which of course nobody knows exactly, you're not going to, in general, find multiple solutions to this well. There's going to be one pair of integers for any given value of t and l. For most values of t and l, there will be no pairs of integers. Given that you don't have complete control over t, it might find a solution where there's at least one pair of integers, but the odds that you find more than one become vanishingly small. And so basically you end up with something that looks like a particle in the sense that you have a single valued energy and momentum that result from putting the field in this funny potential. So again, not probably the most interesting quantization. Still doesn't look like anything we've seen, but that is coming up next. So okay, so the new results. All of this so far, I'm just taking Hamilton's principle too seriously, perhaps. Okay, this guy's running too far with Hamilton's principle. But let's run even further with it. We shouldn't have to drop back Hamiltonian schema if Lagrangian schema doesn't work. And yet, for classical fields anyway, it doesn't work all the time, it seems. And the reason is, let's just go back to particles for a second. We have a particle in one dimension with potential, and you construct the variation of the action. And when you do the integration by parts, you get a boundary term. If you're going to set the extremization of the action to zero, the only way that's going to happen is if this is zero, which gives you f equals ma. And if this is zero, now when is that zero? Well, normally, if we constrain the initial value of x, initial position, and the final position, then now the variation of x on those boundaries is forced to zero by virtue of your boundary conditions. And you get this boundary term to zero. But what if you do a different kind of measurement? What if you do a collision measurement and measure the momentum or velocity or something and leave the position completely undetermined, which we all know is possible, we can do velocity measurements. That would leave the variation of x on the boundary unconstrained, and as long as we're measuring a non-zero velocity, that boundary term is not zero, and if the boundary term is not zero, the variation of the action is not zero. And basically, Hamilton's principle fails. If you look and find a definition of Hamilton's principle somewhere, it usually specifies, it almost always specifies, it has to go from one point in configuration space to another point in configuration space, and it extremizes the action between those two points in configuration space. This is not in configuration space, and it was never really meant to apply to these kind of boundaries where you measure the velocity instead of the position. But I've gotten this far, so let's push Hamilton's principle. Let's actually extend it a little further and say, what if it's always right regardless? What if, even no matter what kind of measurements you do, the action is always extremized? So it's a conjecture. I have a conjecture on the next view graph in nice language. But is there a way to make this happen? It turns out there is, because x dot could be zero. Well, what are the odds that you make a zero velocity measurement? Well, on what reference frame are you making that measurement? It turns out there is always a reference frame in which x dot is zero, right? And basically, you can still apply Hamilton's principle even to these funny boundaries as long as you give up your perhaps illusory freedom that I can constrain what hypersurface I'm constraining my boundary on. In other words, what if I let Hamilton's principle determine the hypersurface that I impose this boundary condition on? And so basically it says I can only measure the velocity of a particle in a reference frame in which the velocity of that particle is zero. And that is exactly what an extended Hamilton's principle would apply. The conjecture is simply this, that boundary conditions inconsistent with an extremized action are not physically realizable. There's no physical way to constrain the system where its action cannot be extremized. Some people, I've found three published papers now that just assume this implicitly and apply the five-dimensional systems. It's maybe you thought this was already true, and now we're rethinking it based on that last view graph. It's a strange conjecture because it's a constraint on constraints, right? I'm just sort of like a meta-constraint on the boundary conditions itself, which are in turn constraints on the system. But I hope by the end I have another way of looking at this conjecture that I hope will make it seem less strange. But let's just run with it and see what happens if we do. Now, there's really no consequences for particles. As I said, you can make a velocity measurement on any hypersurface you want, but only, of any result you want in the lab frame, but only on a hypersurface in which that velocity is zero. So basically, instead of measuring it two times, somehow the extremization of the action forces you to measure along this hypersurface the velocity. If you look through Korn and Hilbert, they call these natural boundary conditions, because you can extremize the action with them. And so basically, the conjecture is that all boundary conditions are natural boundary conditions. Why are there no consequences? There are no consequences because for a particle, the velocity is zero off the world line. So you can just say, well, that was what I measured, but I know it's zero off the world line, so I can just shift reference frame with no danger and just flatten out my hypersurface and come up with exactly the same sort of picture I might have had originally. Fields, on the other hand, it's not zero off the world line, it's fields everywhere, and very strange things happen. Let's take a look back at the relativistic scalar field. You do the same analysis and find what is my boundary term to the delta S for the Klein-Gordon field, the scalar field. This is what the boundary term looks like. It's a closed hypersurface integral over the volume, over the surface of my four volume. So it's a three-dimensional integral. And normally what we do, we say, well, let's fix the field everywhere on that surface, and then this is zero, and the boundary term disappears. That's normally what we do. But in the classical field, classical equations that are governed by second-order differential equations, we may end up constraining, say, the time derivative of the field instead of the field itself. And if so, what we need is for the normal derivative of the field to be zero on this hypersurface everywhere. And this is a much stronger condition on a field because now we have this global condition where somehow the derivative of the field, normal to the hypersurface, is zero everywhere. If you wonder what that means, it just means that your momentum density, based on your stress energy tensor here, is perpendicular to all your space-like hypersurfaces. So basically, there is no three momentum in your hypersurface. This is very analogous to the particle case I just did. You can only measure a field in a on a hypersurface in which there's no three momentum. Okay, what happens? Well, let's look at angular momentum measurements. Okay, so here's my closed hypersurface. I'm going to make an initial measurement and a final measurement. And let's say the initial measurement is a measurement of angular momentum. So I'm only interested in half of my hypersurface. I'm going to make an angular momentum measurement, a preparation, if you like. And here is the way to calculate the angular momentum in classical field theory. You need the stress energy component in the theta direction here. And there's an immediate problem if you make an instantaneous measurement. The immediate problem is at an instant, on that instantaneous hypersurface, you can't have any momentum based on the conjecture. And so it looks like the only possible result you can get is zero angular momentum. Now, this is way too restrictive because I'm forcing a flat hypersurface. It turns out you can still get a non-zero angular momentum. If you have a field swirling around here, and I have to measure it in a reference frame where the angular momentum is always zero, that field has to slope up in the time direction as it goes around the axis. And you end up with, say, for a field uniform b theta, you get this funny corkscrew-shaped hypersurface that has a discontinuity in it. And with if you're going to measure a non-zero angular momentum on one of these hypothesized surfaces that you're allowed to use, you have to put it on something like this with a discontinuity. There's no other way around it unless you want to get a value of zero.
Wait, just a question about that? So the point is you have to bound a space-time volume without
this is just the, this is just the back surface. I haven't even put the future measurement. You might make an energy measurement next or something. This is just the initial measurement.
I see, but aren't you trying to, the boundary of this thing is this is a region of space-time, right? So
right.
The boundary is time-like at some point. So what is it
right.
Like having angular momentum on the defined on the time-like?
Oh, you can, this is not time-like. This has to be space-like to get it to work. Maybe we'll get to talking about time-like surfaces. I think there are interesting things to be done on time-like surfaces, but this is assuming it's basic. Okay, so where does quantization come in? Quantization comes in because of this discontinuity. Now, it only comes in for non-relativistic fields. I do not mean that this field does not obey the Klein-Gordon equation. I mean that let's define a group velocity, a local group velocity, based on the momentum density over the energy density, and make sure that's really small. And when you do that, that implies that the dominant behavior of your solution to the Klein-Gordon equation is the constant frequency. It's oscillating at whatever its natural zero k frequency is. And so you might have varying field amplitudes. This is time and space, and this is the third axis is your field amplitude. So you could have a varying amplitude, and you could have gentle slopes into the time direction. But as long as we're talking about things that correspond presumably to non-relativistic particles, although there are no particles in here yet, we are talking about basically set frequency equal to this value. Now I want to put a hypersurface on this thing that fulfills these requirements. I know that the slope in the time direction is not going to be very high based on my non-relativistic limit. But I also know the normal derivative of the field has to be zero. And that's only going to be true on either the crest or the trough of one of these waves, right? Because the normal derivative is almost exactly in the time direction due to the non-relativistic limit. And so basically, if the normal derivative is zero, it's either on the crest of the wave or the trough of the wave. And this is the only allowable hypersurface you can measure. Now, this is just one spatial dimension. Now, you have to imagine there's another spatial dimension that my hypersurface wraps around like a corkscrew and comes back to the same space location as the corkscrew does. And I'll get to that in a sec. Basically, this wraps off on a crest, and it has to come back on a crest for a trough, because again, this is also one of these natural boundary conditions. And you can see that what you've ended up doing is forcing a quantization of the distance between the corkscrew. The corkscrew might keep going around, but it has to go around with a period equal to a half integer number of cycles of your natural frequency that the spine boarding field is oscillating. So basically, you end up restricting the corkscrew shaped hypersurfaces to periods. Now, the period that you have to have here is either n 2 pi over omega naught or n pi over omega naught, depending on whether or not you can come back on a trough if you start on a crest. I haven't quite proven that there must be some cases where you can go off on a crest and come back on a trough. I can't quite picture how that would work without a field going to zero somewhere. But it might be possible. And so I've left that possibility open, and I've left the crest or trough possibility on there. If you have to come back on another crest, then you double this, and the pi turns into a 2 pi, and you have an integer number of wavelengths between. The slope of this hypersurface at any point is basically, in the time direction, is 1 over the phase velocity, which for the Klein-Gordon equation is proportional to the group velocity, which, as I defined it here, is this momentum density over the energy density. And this matches what I told you earlier. If you're going to measure a flat hypersurface, you can't have any free momentum in that surface. OK, so let's see the problem. The problem is that this type of corkscrew has no solution, because it's dominated by an oscillation at a particular frequency. And that has to be an integer or half integer number of wavelengths. Or periods, because it's time. And it can't be a half integer number of periods, the same half integer number of periods everywhere, because this discontinuity is increasing in space. What instead you need is something that looks like this. This is possible to, this could be a natural boundary condition on a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation with no high frequency components, if this discontinuity is exactly n pi over, or not exactly, but approximately n pi over omega naught. What does this imply? Well, if you say, well, let's calculate delta t, I'm going to do a line integral around here, and I know the slope everywhere, and defined it in terms of, say, what I defined as the group velocity, the local group velocity of the field. You put that in here, and you set that equal to delta t. Suddenly, you manipulate that, and you end up with something that looks very much like Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization. It's not the same. First of all, this is literally not the classical velocity of a particle. It's t0i over t00 in some funny field-defined velocity. And also, there's a factor of 2 in here that would disappear as long as you have to stay from crest to crest instead of allowing go from crest to trough. So I'm trying to get rid of that 2. But then again, maybe the 2 is important. I don't know. What makes me think the 2 might be important is then if you apply this to our old angular momentum measurement, as long as you don't have too much energy sneaking through this discontinuity, then you can approximate this integral of the energy density over your hypersurface as the total energy. And as long as you can build your three-dimensional hypersurface out of these line integrals with constant t00, you end up with this quantization condition on the angular momentum of the classical field. You'll notice, of course, that it is integer multiple of h bar over 2, and in this non-relativistic limit, it's the total energy of the field is mg squared, that last term will cancel out. So again, if the two disappears if you go from crest to crest instead of crest to trough. So that, I think, is sort of a remarkable implication of simply one straightforward conjecture. I've found three papers now, including this last one, which really got me thinking about it. I was emailing this guy, Donatello Dolci, about it, and he was convincing me this is a perfectly straightforward conjecture. I'm not so sure it's straightforward. They were applying it in five-dimensional Kaluza-Klein context. Here I'm just applying it in a four-dimensional context and coming up with quite strange results. So I don't think it's a straightforward conjecture, but it's one simple conjecture, certainly, saying that you can't impose boundary conditions that aren't consistent with Hamilton's principle. You get something that looks like Bohr's number field quantization on classical fields, and you get quantization of angular momentum. What axis is it quantized? Well, it depends what measurement you do. If you impose the measurement in the z-axis of the angular momentum, you quantize it on that axis because that's where the corkscrew is aligned. If you measure a different axis, you quantize it on that axis. And it doesn't matter whether it's the previous measurement or the next measurement, it's still going to be quantized either due to a future measurement or a past measurement, which is depending on what happens in between, of course. The future measurement may not still be quantized when you go back and look at the earlier time behavior, but it's going to be quantized near that measurement. This extra factor of 1/2 that may or may not should perhaps shouldn't be there. Maybe I can remove it if I can prove you have to go from crest to crest. If you try to construct a hypersurface that can constrain a non-zero angular momentum in two different directions, you find you can't do it. Not because these are operators that commute, but simply because there's no consistent hypersurface, natural boundary condition, that have these funny conditions for both for two different directions at the same time. So this is not, these are not operators, remember, these are sort of classical field measurements. This first equation, of course, is actually a much stronger result. This, there are a bunch of additional things that have to happen to get this. This is a much stronger result, and it's this analog to Bohr sum of field quantization. You don't expect quantized energies for a free scalar field, but now I'm hoping I'll just put some potentials on here and see if this result is going to give me all my quantized energies as well. And the quantization is not exact. It fails for relativistic group velocities. And again, I just want to stress that there's no particle here, there's no quantum field here, there's no operators. This is just classical fields with one funny conjecture. Let's see, how are we doing on time? Ah, there we go. Okay, maybe I'll do this and then one more and then stop. How do you do probability in a block universe? First of all, we only are concerned about probabilities concerning our boundary conditions. We don't have to ask questions about field parameters that aren't constrained. Why not? Well, I guess as Chris Fuchs might say, if you can't bet on it, it's not probability. So if you can't measure it, there's no meaning to probability. But I'm only going to be asking questions about the boundary conditions. And that's because where you get information out is at the boundary conditions. Now, these are epistemic probabilities. So we need to get away from this idea that we need to conserve probability current. That's treating probability like a real substance. Epistemic probabilities are not governed by a conserved current. We don't need a conserved current for probability. We just need a global expression. Typically, what you do in space-time is you have an initial state and a final state, and you want to construct a conditional probability. But of course, if you slice space-time a different way, now you have some other conditional probability that's going to be different. So things get complicated, what foliation are we going to use. It's far more natural to just do a joint probability distribution on the whole surface. In other words, why not just define a probability distribution on the entire hypersurface and its shape? And again, Steve, it's the, both the choice of measurement and the result of the measurement are hiding here. And then why not use just the classical action that works so well in quantum field theory as the definition of this? Now, this automatically normalizes. If you take a joint probability distribution like this and you want to construct a conditional probability, well, you can hack it any way you want, right? This is the fundamental thing. You can hack it any way you want and then normalize over in the usual way to go from joint probabilities to conditional probabilities. And this actually is exactly what Robert Ockel is doing in his general boundary formulation, where he's viewing the whole hypersurface as one thing and then normalizing based on the possible results for a past and future surface. And this is another way to think about that earlier conjecture, too. The earlier conjecture said, if you can't extremize the action, you can't constrain it, which seems a little strange. But it makes a lot more sense in this picture. Because if you can't extremize the action, you don't have any stationary phase terms in this integral. And if you don't have any stationary phase terms in this integral, it's going to be very small, if not zero. So why not say, well, you can do it, just the probability of that global boundary is zero. And then it's not like, you're not allowed to do those measurements. It's just the probability of you doing those kind of measurements becomes vanishingly small. And I think this is a nicer way to think about that related conjecture, rather than constraining the constraints. You can just say, okay, all boundary conditions are allowed with this probability, and it just so happens that if you don't extremize the action, that probability is zero. Okay, I am running way low on time. I need to mention that this picture has some missing pieces. The biggest missing pieces are not adding particles, but subtracting particles. The many, many particle limit, of course, is a lot closer to classical field theory than the one particle limit. It's dropping from many to few particles. That's the trick. And for that, you need something like mass energy quantization. And finally, what comes so easily for realistic particle pictures, why, when you do these boundary conditions, why are the positions always localized for single particles? I don't yet have any reason why I need to impose local boundary conditions for single particles. Although it works perfectly well for many particles, which aren't localized anyway, for many identical particles. I have some ideas in dealing with this, some of which may not work, and I'm not going to talk about. One thing I'm looking at is actually adding the mass tower, which is a way to relate periodicity to mass energy quantization. And I have nothing if I don't have periodicity constraints on this thing. So I can get my periodicity constraints. And so if I can get mass energy quantization by adding another dimension, if that's how I have to do it, so be it. And I'm also looking at position measurements actually only on time-like surfaces, which is actually, if you think about the detector, detectors are on time-like surfaces. They are not on space-like surfaces. And so then we need to rethink what's happening on time-like surfaces and not think of position measurements on space-like surfaces at all. So I'll just leave a couple lessons that I'm drawing from this and I'd like you to think about, which is that if we're going all the way back to the beginning anyway, let's try to keep general relativity, at least the possibility of adding it in as an important guide as we construct, as we try to reconstruct quantum mechanics and quantum theory. If you're interested more about the leap from the second order Klein-Gordon equation to the Schrödinger equation, I'll direct you to an archive paper I need to update to a later version. But that, I think, it may be, if this is all right, that's a scene of the crime, because that's where you go from a second order equation where you don't know all the initial conditions to a first order equation where you think you do. And so we've had this fiction that we know the wave function, but we don't, because we've actually thrown out half of the solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, and we simply don't know the solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, even though we think we know the solution to the Schrödinger equation. And that would make the ordinary quantum wave function epistemic, because it just corresponds to what we happen to know. Well, meanwhile, there's this natural ontic structure of a classical field. And then the last thing I'll leave you guys with is, I think, how we need to start thinking about measurements of boundary conditions, which is get rid of this three-pronged approach of the new initial measurement. We have spatial boundary conditions where we evolve it, and then we do a measurement. We treat all three of these differently. But in a block universe view, it's maybe just not more to actually view this one big constraint in space. Thank you very much.
Sure. So you said something a little bit about why having these final boundary conditions doesn't necessarily lead to causal paradoxes and so on. So I was just going to ask you about supernuminal signaling. So you can use this kind of argument to say, well, you know, Bell's theorem usually says that, you know, quantum mechanics isn't compatible with a sort of relativistic principle of common cause of local causality. But I've got this backward causation kind of picture. It gets rid of that problem.
Right.
But it also opens the door to superluminal.
Except that the Klein-Gordon equation and all these covariant equations don't allow for that. So as long as the equations of motion don't have superluminal propagation in them, you're not going to be easily send information from one point to another. There are these global constraints on these surfaces of global probability, but whether or not you can get signaling out of that is not clear. In fact, that may be and an interesting postulate to say, well, what if we can't? What are the consequences?
Because you could, you introduce this backward causation, gets rid of the problem with Bell's, the principle of common cause for outcomes of the Bell experiment, but it also might apply to things which you ordinarily wouldn't want to, would consider superluminal.
Sure. You want to violate Bell, but you don't want the superluminal signaling, for sure. Yeah. And that has to come out of here somehow.
That's so. Just working, yeah, that's just something.
A couple of questions. One, early in the talk, this gets back to what Joe was getting at. You said the hidden variables are influenced by future boundary.
That's one way to think about it, sure.
But given that your initial boundary condition is just, say, a set of field values or configuration or a single configuration for the field, I mean, the natural rejoinder, especially given you're using the ordinary action principle, is your hidden variables are just the velocities. And
right. So they're on there. They exist. They're there. They're hidden. You don't know them until we can reconstruct them later. But
as Rob was saying, sort of by hypothesis, you can only know half the data. And the other half are the velocities. And these somehow so you basically have an ordinary evolution in phase space, but somehow this is supposed to not be a local.
You can see it's not local from the form of the probability. I mean, this is the probability of a non-local structure. Okay, this is the probability of a spatially extended structure, and it is this.
I'm not sure what it is. Exactly.
Well, it's the probability that the field values. And everywhere on the surface are their value, and the surface is this shape. And you create it by doing this to the classical action. If that is the right thing, if that's the right equation, probability is inherently non-local. All right? I mean, because you're discussing what's the probability of this structure in space-time.
So which of Bell's assumptions have you violated?
If you look at it, yeah.
Statistical independence.
It's
or which does this violate?
If this wasn't squared.
Yeah.
Oh no, wait, I'm thinking of my other paper. Which am I violating? I have always thought of it as violating the retrocausality loophole.
Statistical independence.
Right. But maybe maybe there's more to it than that in this picture.
All right. Well, I suppose, I mean, that's related to my second question. I'll just say it briefly. You say that there you have, so the statistical independence, the retrocausation loophole, has to do with the relation between the initial hidden states and the final detector setting. So there you have a model of external measurement. You have something that is external detector settings. And that sort of keeps coming up here. You talk about it being some sort of fact of the matter as to what is one chooses to measure.
Sure. Well, in a block universe, there's no time. So
I mean, it's just, but there's, well, or a fact of the matter as to what is being measured now. I mean, I don't know if I can think of it.
Oh, yeah. So there's a fact of the matter. Sure. You measure the angular, let's say, measure the angular momentum here, measure the energy here.
But if somebody looks at this block universe at any given, and you just sort of put your pen on some event and ask this person, what's being measured here? Is there going to be, how am I going to answer that question?
Measurement theory, and classical field theory, if there's an energy density, there's an momentum density from the stress energy tensor, that is the tools you use, not operator math, but classical stress energy tensor is how you answer
that question. But that has all the information in it. That doesn't have half.
Sure. Well, then what properties of it are you measuring? And then you can, it's epistemic or something, right? So you're only measuring.
That's what I'm getting at.
Half of those properties.
Right.
Which half? You're asking which half?
Yeah. How do I know? Looking at this whole system from outside, which half is being measured?
It's not always.
Well, you're saying it's epistemic, so I suppose maybe that's not a fair question, but then the whole account is supposed to be sort of an ontic account of quantum.
I'll go as far as saying, if you measure the position, you're measuring T00, you're measuring the energy density. measuring momentum, you're measuring the time derivative of the field in T01. If more complicated measurements like angular momentum, you can see it's not trivial to say which of these components am I measuring.
Okay, and if nobody's doing any measuring, then
you have no information, so you can't build the probabilities. Yeah. Like right here is a space time volume from here to here in time. Okay, I know very little information about that height, that four volume, so I can't really tell you any probabilistic outcomes or what I expect. Yeah.
So the optic state at the initial condition is going to depend on what I choose to find out, and somehow the collection of information, not just the state, the final boundary condition.
But what you get, the measurement
result of a measurement.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. And that's why it looks like retro causality, because you have something that's supposed to occur. It's a funny thing to introduce into a blocked universe.
People do it in 3D all the time. It doesn't bother anyone in 3D. I just want to do it in 4D.
Okay.
I think where you get the quantization of angular momentum, it strikes me that you could possibly devise an argument that was independent of the setting of the whole setup you've got here in terms of forcing the boundary terms in the action optimization to be zero. So I'm imagining just Bohr's model of the atom, for example. You say, suppose the electron is not a particle, but rather a field.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's lots of solutions for a field. But suppose we focus on the standing waves.
Okay.
And you could say, well, the fields that are standing waves about the nucleus.
You're saying in 3D.
Yeah,
okay.
In 3D, they have an integer number of wavelengths.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's some energy quantity that you could ascribe to that possible field, which was proportional to the number of wavelengths, then you found quantization of that energy. And so similarly, it seems to me you could say, suppose particles were classical fields, and we define an angular momentum in terms of that field quantity. The constraint that as you corkscrew up, you should meet the crest feels to me like a standing wave type of condition.
You can see it. It's just from the fact that you get the same orthogonal probability quantization. No.
So this argument never appeared before in the history of quantum mechanics, that we can think of quantization of angular momentum as the result of a heuristic argument involving standing waves and classical fields?
In block universe framework, I've never seen it, but this is all in the last month or two. Perhaps search. Anyone knows it?
Does anyone know the general form of the Bohr-Sommerfeld condition of the motivation was?
Well, going back to the Bohr, right? This is integral number of waves going around in a circle, and having to match up, doing that quantization condition thing over there.
You mean Bohr?
No, that was Jabulda's idea. It was De Broglie's idea. I mean, Bohr just wrote down the quantization condition, and De Broglie explained it in terms of wavelengths and fit.
But I'm not sure if he said waves of any of either or something. I don't know.
He reached the Einstein relation of light.
More questions for Ken?
I'm wondering how you're going to get particles converging at points.
I am too. That's what I would ask God, yes.
It seems like the nature of the field to be dispersive, and then when you actually make a measurement, you get somehow all the energy coalescing in one point.
Well, but the cause, it's what's the cause? If we think of the cause has to be in the past, we're never going to get there. But if the cause is the measurement, and that, it doesn't bother anyone why, after you make a localized measurement, that the wave function is localized around that point. It doesn't bother anyone, right? Why should it bother you that right before you make it, it's localized around that point? It's just the same argument flipped around in time. It's a final boundary condition. We're not used to final boundary conditions. But if you imagine that is the cause of the subsystem, then the question then is what made that cause in the first place? So then you back up a little bit to quantum cosmology, and you keep backing up and backing up and backing up, and you end up not at a measurement boundary condition, but at a cosmological boundary condition. And you just do the same math. So that's my my argument of how this is consistent with a path to doing quantum cosmology. You just make the math between your measurement and the boundary conditions on the universe.
So you'd say as a to be consistent with the measurement of, say, one particle propagating and being absorbed by another map, that you actually have to have a classical field that is a superposition of solutions such that the field is actually possible.
Converge onto that point, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
All right.
Yes.
Then you mentioned there might actually be an argument from Ballantyne about the genericness of quantization conditions.
It is faster.
Boundary conditions, yeah. It rings a bell now when I think about it. So maybe it's worth looking at.
He didn't like the early version of this at all, but I'll look at it for sure.
One final question for you. So I was not convinced that there's any retrocausation going on here because, you know, I asked the question, couldn't you think of this as conditioning from the future to the past? And I wasn't convinced by your response. Okay. I really had to think of it as causation.
Okay.
But rather than go into a discussion of that, my question is this. I mean, couldn't it be that, suppose it were the case that ultimately what you've got here is something that's actually local, maybe what you've got is not a recovery of quantum mechanics, but a proof that certain features of quantum mechanics can be accommodated within a local classical model.
Okay.
And I guess my question to you is, how wedded are you in your program to, you know, this being a rederivation of quantum mechanics as opposed to merely a demonstration that some of the features of quantum mechanics can be accommodated?
Well, I'd settle for the latter, but I'm in this for the former, and
okay.
I see it as I see that our human intuitions about time are the roadblock here, and I mean, it's been a long time, and we're still debating these foundations, and something counterintuitive is going on. And the one place where I see that the physics is telling us our intuition is wrong is when it comes to time. And backward causation doesn't scare me anymore, but I realize it scares a lot of people. So, but I still see that as the answer to all the deepest mysteries. Yeah.
Well, let's thank Ken again.